I want to clarify what my title means, actually. By real people, I pretty much mean none of you. Yeah. So most of you in this room are obviously here because you have a big interest in data. Some of you probably even have a computer science degree, or you have some quite high-functioning interest in science and how it works. And basically, you are not the people I try and work for. I try to make products with data. I've been doing it for about 5 years. I'm going to rock through a whole load of examples about the mistakes I've made and things I've learned about how you try and transmit highly complex, abstract, data-driven things to people who probably have no interest in data and are probably not in this room. So that's what real people means, not you. So to go into a bit of the challenge and the problems I work through, I'm going to start with what I'm currently working on and then go through a whole lot of back history. So this is the one reference I'll have to the company life. And the company's alert me. And we're in this sort of Internet of Things space, which is quite fashionable, quite trendy at the moment, because there's a lot happening there. There's a huge amount of sensors becoming available. They communicate in real time. And there's various home platforms available, of which we are one, which are doing things with that data, being able to create services. And actually what the Internet of Things really is a whole lot of noise. For example, I have a window sensor. My window sensor, for nearly 24 hours of the day, is saying, window is closed, window is closed, window is closed, window is closed, which is not a compelling product feature for the consumer market. Being able to do something interesting with that data, for example, when knowing the window is open and it's about to rain in 10 minutes, then that's something interesting that you can tell somebody. However, the vast majority of data out there on the Internet of Things is noise. And as we all know, the cliche with data is you want to find the signal within that noise. So that's the challenge out there. Huge amount of sensors communicating in real time. Find something interesting and compelling to tell to people. And my particular focus of late is energy. We're going to come back into that. But I spent quite a few years making products and visualizing big data. Now, I used to have a big talk, and I did it perhaps 2 years ago at OpenTech. And the whole meme of it was that data visualization is storytelling. But I had to kind of put that meme to bed and come up with something a bit more structured. And that's it. It's quite simple, very, very easy. 4 rules of visualization, i.e. turning data into something that works for real people who are normal. When you're making a consumer-facing product with lots of data, absolutely has to be personalized. If you're not telling them something which is highly interesting to that person looking at their data, then you shouldn't bother. Also, it should be worthwhile, particularly with energy. It's quite easy to say you could save 15 pence by doing something. People are not motivated by saving 15 pence, as a simple example, so it has to be actually worthwhile for somebody to be interested in it. Accessible, I'll show you a few examples of that, but basically understandable. One of the interesting things is that if you look at a graph of the number of people studying science subjects in school or high school, whatever it is, you'll find that as it progresses past 13 like that, the graph is going down and to the right, i.e. there's much less people studying science as they get older. And actually, not many people are interested in science. And there is a kind of fascination with presenting huge amounts of data. And I've been there, and I'll show you an example. It's quite easy to set people a science exam. And a science exam turns people off, and they're not interested in that. So creating accessible data visualizations is really challenging. I'm going to show you some examples about where I've gone wrong and also some successful stuff. Actionable. If you are presenting data in a consumer product, it's no use just giving them a bland fact or a bland amount of data. There has to be something they can do about it. Again, I'll come back to that. And instinctive is a brand new one for me. Work quite a lot with behaviour science these days. Behavioural science can tell you a lot about the context, the environment that people are making decisions in, particularly where I am in energy. We've worked quite a lot with behavioural science to understand the context and the environment that those decisions are made in. I can show you one great example of where I got that terribly wrong very, very early on, that I didn't include instinct in how we visualise data to people. So I'm going to just kick off now with lots of use cases and studies of things we've done. and this is where we began actually. It's about 5 years ago. I was doing a lot with transport data. I used to work for TfL and do various things for them and design systems around real-time analytics. That's actually the public transport network in London. Lots of trains, buses, underground, all flying around. And I was very interested in that data. And I also started working with a couple of startups. And one of them was Nestoria, who are a real estate search engine. And this was the first product I made with lots of data, all about 5 years ago. And as you can see, I'm trying to create a highly personalised thing to show you where can you find a home which is the best place for you to live in the context that I know you have to travel across London to get to work. So I've crunched large, large quantities of data, lots of transport data, a lot of house pricing data. Some of it succeeded quite well. I think we were quite successful in making the concept of travel time quite accessible. We used quite a simple clock graphic to summarise that something is about 30 minutes away or something is about 15 minutes away. We also, this is back in about 2008, we also had custom map cartography, and we hid nearly all of the information that you used to find on maps in those days. It's quite common now to have customised map cartography, but back then it wasn't. So we were trying to hide a lot of the information. The tube overlays were not so successful. But with some things it did very well. One thing that it completely failed at, and if you're a budding entrepreneur and if you've done lots of things out there and whatever, TechCrunch and all that kind of coverage, but nobody used it. Which is a good place to be with your first product. Nobody uses it. You learn a lot of hard lessons that way. Instinctive. There was nothing about this that was instinctive. Following it, having discussed a lot of people with a lot of people, having conversations about how people search for property, most people have already decided where they want to live. It's more about the detail of the actual property that they're going to buy, where they want to live. So it just didn't fit into the rationale or the behaviour of how people make a decision about buying a place to live. Sorry, about buying a home. It's more about the details of the actual property than the location. Excuse me, a little bit dry. But that was the first hard lesson about making stuff instinctive. And I'm going to come back with some stuff we've been doing recently around that. To carry on, I've worked with great teams, and we did some great stuff. And one of them is Eto World. I'm not going to show so much of their visualizations today. I did that a couple of years ago. But I learned a lot with them visualizing stuff for the media and getting publicized a lot. We did TED, we did Guardian, we did the BBC, and we did Wired. And I have to say that at the end of all of that, it's very interesting to see what kind of conversation and what communication we got out of that data visualization. And it really was catering to a niche. We were creating beautiful, beautiful data visualization. Incredible stuff. Worked with great, talented people. However, really created for technologists and people interested in data and talking about it. I just want to show you actually the one thing that we did get the largest amount of conversation, biggest amount of people really, really interested in this stuff. Was in the Daily Mail. These guys actually really, really understand how to communicate with the people who are reading their newspapers or reading their website. Very, very interesting how they approach stuff. The first time we worked with them was on this stuff. And the first thing we wanted to do was produce a map. However, they came back and they asked us for something, when we first asked about it, we were a bit, kind of perturbed about it. It's like, well, we're great at data visualization, so why would you ask us for this? Which was a top 10 list, which just seemed kind of trivial for data visualization people. The response was actually really, really interesting, because when you look at it, it is a perfectly hierarchical visualization of the most important information you might want to look at. And it was the number one news article on the Daily Mail website for 2 days in a row. And if you know the Daily Mail, it's one of the huge, huge sources of traffic on the UK web and around the world. Absolutely massive. a huge amount of conversation going on around it. And actually, a particular point of pride was that we managed to get the Daily Mail readership worried about house prices and crime. So that was quite a nice outcome. But you know, joking aside, they understood how to communicate with the people who are reading their newspaper. And actually, a top 10 list, although as trivial as it may seem, was actually quite personalised for a lot of people. Somebody who lived in Newcastle could look at number 5 and go, yeah, I know Newgate Street. I don't know it personally, but I can imagine perhaps the High Street, where everyone goes out drinking on a Friday night. So there's a huge amount of incidents there. And people who live in Newcastle could look at that and go, yes, I recognise that. That's very relevant to me. I know it's dangerous and I don't go there with my family. People could comment on this. People could talk about it online. Much, much more personalised than something as abstract as a map. Very interesting to us. The big story, actually, with all this data was that the data quality was very bad. This was the crime.org, the first release. And the story quite rapidly became, actually, that, for example, not sure if this is the case, but Preston, the people who lived around Glover's Court said, well, actually, it's a really safe neighbourhood because it's where the big police station is. And it turns out that most of the incidents recorded at that police station were just dodgy data points because they hadn't recorded where they were in the field, but they were recorded at the police station. Separate story about government data, that's not my field. Somebody else can pick up that baton. Spent too long in that field. Incredibly interesting for us to see the reaction. Hundreds and hundreds of comments, people talking about this stuff, because it was very, very easy for them to grasp what it was trying to show to them. Something that we missed out on quite a lot of the stuff when we focused on very beautiful but quite technical visualizations for a technical audience. So accessibility, a constant quest and drive for simplicity is what it turns out to be. So current stuff. I learned importantly that studying the conversations, how people talk about something, it's crucially important to be able to turn data into something that people will understand around that. And energy is an interesting thing. People don't actually talk about energy. Nobody talks about on Saturday, I used 15 kilowatt hours. What's 15 kilowatt hours? What's tangible about that? What people do is they charge their mobile device, they roast the chicken on Sunday, they use some lights, or you know, they're playing PlayStation for a couple of hours a day. People have behaviours, they have activities, they have devices. Those things use energy. That's actually what's relevant to people in the home. And this is what you get. This is actually one of my bills. It's quite a high one. That was a nice surprise. After 3 months, you receive a bill. So after all that time spent in front of a laptop or listening to music or having the lights on, you just get a very large figure. And the best part is when they try and explain the bill, you get about six pages. Six pages of explanation about my energy, and it's just lots and lots of numbers. I've got no idea. Did I spend it on lights? Did I spend it on heating? Am I doing something abnormal which caused my very large electricity bill? It turns out there was something quite abnormal in my home, but I didn't notice at the time. I certainly couldn't pull out of this. So we're trying to work out how can we actually explain to people their energy use. And the context of that environment is this. So we do a lot of user testing, try to have a conversation with people, and we try and understand how people interact with their homes and what's going on. Thermostat lady is actually very intelligent and making a perfectly rational decision in that she doesn't understand how to use a thermostat. And if you look at most thermostats, they're designed by engineers for engineers. They have up and down arrows and they have degrees on it and they have quite complicated calendar and schedule settings. And most people, what they actually care about is being warm or comfortable. Am I comfortable in my home right now? Am I warm enough? Or do I feel too cold? That's it. And the thermostats are generally quite poorly designed. And for her, the rational decision was, I feel cold, and I know what turns the heating on, and that's to put my thermostat in the fridge, and that turns the heating on. perfectly rational decision. That's the challenge of trying to create a more intelligent home and help people do stuff. So, some of the stuff I work with is this. This is a smart meter. Pumps out a lot of data. They're rolling these out to 26 million homes in the UK. There's going to be 45 million of these. They take a reading, take a sample point every 30 minutes, how much energy you've used in your home. Now, Internet of Things, well, I need to speed up, I see. Internet of Things, so lots of data being pushed around there. Hopefully, in the future, we will have sensors and everything. We will know how much energy that is using. We can turn it off, we can control the projector, we can control the heating system. But not right there yet. There's one end of the spectrum, and that's completely statistical. And the other end of the spectrum is having a sensor on everything and knowing how much energy everything is using and being able to control it. So we're somewhere in between in the middle. We have sensors all over our homes, all over our engineers' homes, our data scientists' homes, creating models about how people use energy, the typical use of devices, how often you use stuff. We try and collect as much information we can from people who are using our services. Have a contract. If you tell us information, the only reason we would ask it is so we can give you more information back. Very important to have a contract with the customer. Make sure they know what they're getting back and adding value. So we're applying models and lots of data science to the stuff. I'm going to have to speed up. I'm going to say a distinct... We're at a distinct disadvantage in that although we're rolling this out to a lot of homes across the UK through our sort of partners, and one of those is British Gas. So if you're a British Gas customer and you've got a smart meter, you're going to start receiving our service, or probably already have it. Can't actually show it to you because they're not going public with it. It is out there in the domain. But I can show you some of the early prototypes and where it went wrong, where we didn't make stuff accessible. So just very, very briefly. Pie charts. There is a time and a place for pie charts, and that's in Microsoft Office, and they should never leave Microsoft Office. Thank you very much.
Good job.
Classic mental jumps I'm supposed to make. I'm supposed to understand that the yellow or orange is slightly smaller, larger than the blue. I can look across here and see orange. I can see orange, that's hot water. That is slightly smaller than that. No, actually, it's the same up. Don't bother. Pie chart, absolutely useless. A nice hierarchical list of where people are using. You can add some visualization to give people a clue of what's larger, smaller, da da da. Pie charts, don't go anywhere near them. One thing I really, really want to emphasize is the language of the domain. So this is the first UI I inherited, actually, when I just joined the company. We decided that it was... when the first requirement you receive for something data-related or visualizing data, the first requirement you'll often see written down is dashboard. Dashboard is the language of business intelligence. Business intelligence is for people who like looking at charts, who like having widgets, who like having graphs, who have four different ways of doing stuff. And we basically set a science exam for users. And funnily enough, out of six people we tested with, the question we most asked was, what is a dashboard? So absolutely crucial. Step back away from business intelligence, step back from that stuff, keep it accessible, keep it simple. And if I can... There we go. Four rules of visualization. Stick to those.
Great talk by Chris. Show your appreciation. We'll save the questions to the end in some way if we've got time. Otherwise, you might have to throw up Chris after the end of the session.
Sorry, I've got a big mouth.
No, it's absolutely fascinating. I was so enthralled I wasn't even looking at my watch.
Be a very short talk. Firstly, apologies if anyone suffers from motion sickness. My name's Duncan Ross. I have a day job. I work for a large company doing evil things. However, I have a separate hat, and that is as one of the directors of DataKind UK. And generally speaking, when you go to conferences, there are two kinds of presentations which have a particularly niche audience: technical presentations and presentations about ethics. So I thought I'd combine the two in an attempt to really break the mould here. So the starting point, usually, for discussions about ethics is, certainly in big companies, is, I don't care about ethics, what does the law say? Okay. Now, the problem with the law and technology is a pretty obvious one. And let's take everyone's favourite, EU 9546EC. Does everyone know what that is? Hands up if you know what EU 9546EC is.
It's the Bill of Rights.
It's not the Bill of Rights. It's actually the Data Protection Directive. So you really ought to know what that is. But as you can tell from that number, 95, the EU Data Directive was created when Internet Explorer was thought of as a cool and trendy and new thing. Okay? So it's a bit worrying, isn't it? Actually, 95, was that Windows 3.1? I lose track. We have laws. You are making assumption that Microsoft brought something out in the right year. But the point is that the thing that underlies data protection legislation was actually created before most of the data problems we're thinking about existed. And it's no surprise that it doesn't actually fit into the way people use the internet or people use the World Wide Web, never mind the Internet of Things. So that's a big problem. In the US, things are even worse because the key legal document that frames discussions around privacy, etc., was written in 1791, okay, which predates lots of stuff. So we've got big problems here in terms of legislation. Okay? And when they do talk about this kind of stuff, it tends to be privacy and freedom of speech and all these important things. Fine, great, important, but not really easily transposable to the world we're living in at the moment. So if law isn't going to be the answer, normally I talk more about this because I'm not a lawyer. Okay. If law isn't going to be the answer, what's the next step? Well, companies then say, let's concentrate. If we can't concentrate on the law, because it doesn't help us much, let's think about the next most obvious thing, which is, as Google puts it, do no evil. Or as one of my friends puts it, they just put an extra word in there that doesn't make much sense. In fact, it was an MP said that recently. So, is an alternative, if you can't use the law as a guide to your ethical position in terms of data, is an alternative just to say, well, okay, if I can't do that, can I just not do evil? Is that sufficient? And Google have made a big thing about this, but as we've seen from Google's actual behaviour, there is a huge difference between simply trying to passively not do evil and actually not doing evil. Now, if you take, for example, the Google Street Map thing, not Google Street Map, what they call it, that car that went around photographing
Street
everyone.
View.
Street View, thank you. What a great, helpful audience you are. So Google Street View, they go around taking photos, and there's a question about the ethics of, well, what happens if you catch me coming out of my mistress's house, etc. Okay, well, you can blank that out, that's fine. But there was a more important question. One of the engineers there had accidentally written a bit of code, as you accidentally do every now and again. I'm sure we've all done this accidentally. I wrote a bit of code, and I wasn't really awake, that slipped Wi-Fi signals and Wi-Fi addresses as it drove past, and then they didn't tell anyone about this, and then someone found out, and it got blown up out of proportion. It was innocent, I'm sure. I don't believe that engineer was doing something that they thought was deliberately going to be against the law in Germany, France, Finland, and pretty much anywhere else which subscribed to EU 9546EC. But they did. And it was actually unethical. So, if we can't say passivity is sufficient, what can we do? Well, I'm going to take you through some things very quickly because my previous speaker was interesting for too long. It should be interesting for short periods of time. Some things you can actively do. Now, you've all chosen not to listen to the NHS Hack Day presentation that's going on in A at the moment. So, I'm going to tell you about NHS Hack Days instead. You can't escape NHS Hack Days because
you're hacking the agenda.
That's a meta hack. We're all invested here in the NHS, one way or the other. Okay, and it's a huge organisation, and although it does a very good job, there is no doubt that it can do some things better. And the NHS Hack Days started off as a way of trying to circumvent the large IT approach that the British government excels at, and getting people to actually do things directly with data and directly to address problems that they saw in the NHS. And there is a hack day here in this building next weekend. And if you want to get involved in it, please look up the NHS Hack Day wiki and see how you can sign up for that and help the NHS Hack Day people. The second thing, which is on a slightly larger scale, is set up by a small local organisation in New York called the UN. And the UN Director General said, I want to see if we can improve the world using data. Okay, but being the UN Secretary General, he did this out in a three-hour speech. And so they've set up UN Global Pulse. And the idea of UN Global Pulse is they bring together volunteers and they address big, challenging questions. And this is really interesting. So their questions are things like, are there better ways of finding out when there is a famine in Africa? Because the way they tend to find out if there's a famine in Africa at the moment is one day 200,000 people turn up at a border, okay? Mass migration, the first thing you know about it is suddenly you've got to create refugee camps out of nothing. And it's incredibly difficult in terms of development and aid to deal with that kind of situation. Were there things they could have seen in the data beforehand which would have given them a warning that this was happening? And it turns out there are, in that kind of circumstance. You can actually see trends and things in the data that might lead you to that conclusion. Now, where does this get into open data? Well, some of this data is actually from open sources. It can be information from weather data. It can be information from food price data. Food price data is great for noticing these things. If you see a spike in prices for things that are so affected by the weather, well, lo and behold, you can probably guess there's a scarcity there. A very interesting thing happened, though. A company, again, another small company called Orange. I say Orange because it's the French part of Orange. Orange decided they were going to go one stage further. They had a set of private data from Sierra Leone. No, sorry, I lied, Ivory Coast. And they said, we're going to make available anonymized telephone records from the Ivory Coast for the purpose of development. So you can go to the UN under the D4D challenge, and you can say, you can put together a team, and you can say, I want access to this data, and I want to research it to see if we can tell things about the behaviour of people in the Ivory Coast that would help the development agenda. It's one of the first examples of a private sector company opening up their data for public good. It's really, really positive. And if you think that there are ethical issues about putting that data out there, how do I deal with anonymisation, etc., believe me, Ivory Coast is a great place to try that because Ivory Coast has had coups recently, so there are real issues about making data available, and they've had to think very long and hard about how do I anonymise that data so that the police don't turn up on your doorstep and drag you away in the middle of the night, which is not a beneficial thing in terms of development. So there's UN Global Pulse. But UN Global Pulse is kind of a high-level thing, and it's kind of scary to think about. You know, it's dealing with really, really big issues, and they're important, they need to be addressed. But is there something much more practical that we could do as individuals? Obviously, the answer to that is yes, otherwise I wouldn't be here.
That's a good question.
There's a lot of potential in open sensor networks and all this technology. But I think we have to combine it with other things. And I'm sort of following on here from a bit definitely from what Duncan was saying, and I'm referencing stuff that Chris was talking about. I think participatory, right, is one of the key things to this stuff. There's a long history of participatory technology. Participatory video has a long and noble history in development. There's a participatory mapping now, obviously, right? That's really huge. This is Map Kibera, the Nairobi slum, where the residents were enabled to map their own space, which was completely unmapped before that. And moreover, if we're going to do that with the makey stuff and the sensory stuff, right, we've got the learning spaces, we've got the hack labs and the fab labs and the maker spaces. Okay, so the components are there for a truly participatory approach to this stuff. So the system-powered sensors. So what might kick that off? Well, there are some great examples around already. These are probably familiar to you. This is the balloon mapping that gave birth to the public laboratory. This was the Gulf Oil Coast oil spill, the balloon and kite mapping that was largely through the affordances of somebody having a bright idea, but also the fact that the cheap Canon cameras had an SDK you could hack to take photos every 5 seconds or whatever, and stitch it together cleverly afterwards in the manner that Chris does with the geodata stuff. Well, sorry about that. So a crisis is what I'm trying to get to. A crisis gets bums off seats. A crisis overcomes the stratification that we all face in our everyday lives and our everyday organisations. It gets people and ideas out there and they do stuff. And another example is Safecast, which is the DIY guide counters that were created in or partly in the hackspace in Tokyo and housed in plastic lunchboxes initially and connected to COSM, which is now Zively. So the thing I drive this way is participatory. Also, there's a common sort of DNA of a scepticism, right? You know, that phrase, there is no cause for alarm. Okay, that sort of common phrase is mobilised by a sort of scepticism towards the sort of authoritative narrative around this stuff. So it's kind of participatory and it's sort of critical. And I think there's plenty of other opportunities. I came across a great quote from 2010. There were some really bad floods in 2009 in a place called Cockermouth in Cumbria. So here's a quote. One crucial lesson for other areas at risk of flooding is that local communities need to be much more involved, says Sue Cashmore, chair of the Cockermouth Flood Action Group. The community needs to take responsibility for its future. We know our rivers, we know our rainfall, and we know our vulnerable people. It was fantastic having all the agencies in last year, but it was a top-down approach. She wants a bottom-up approach, getting agencies to work together. The environmental agency says ours is the river water, the council says ours is the surface water, and nobody wants to know about the groundwater. I don't care whose bloody water it is, it all comes from the sky, doesn't it? I mean, that's a perfect opportunity for some participatory citizen science. The water monitor technology is already there, connected together during open sensor networks. Away you go. So I'm calling this stuff citizen science, or critical citizen science, but there's lots of citizen science about it. That's a pretty broad church. And this stuff, you know, if it lights a fuse, that's fine. This is the LHC at home. This is participate in particle physics from your computer. Okay, that's that kind of citizen science, right? Which is not the kind I'm talking about, because that's the kind that's basically immaterial labour, sort of distributed, small task stuff. In some sense, you become the sensor in that kind of citizen science, and that's not what I'm talking about. What I want to talk about is much more like this guy's science, actually. Does anyone see the Fantastic Mr. Feynman?
Yeah.
Well, a really rocking programme that was. It's on BBC iPlayer. Really great. And I mean, he had a very sceptical approach, actually, towards the authoritative narrative, even though he's involved in such dark stuff. I mean, it's really quite bad, isn't it? He pioneered parallel processing before computers existed, because he was a junior scientist in charge of the people who were doing the manual calculations for the Manhattan Project, which was the nuclear bomb. Okay, so he did the calculations in parallel. And so in a weird way, in parallel processing, of course, underwrites big data. So not only was he involved in the Manhattan Project, he's also, you know, anyway, that's pretty dark. But one of the good things was this stuff, right, which is, it was he broke through the cover-up around the Challenger disaster, and he did this kind of theatrical thing in the Inquiry of dipping the O-ring, which is the bit that leaked on the Challenger booster that exploded, and he dipped it on TV, which is the medium that was then. He dipped it in the ice water and said, look, this stuff doesn't hold up under those conditions. What do you expect? In fact, he wrote a letter on that programme. He wrote a letter home to his wife just when he got to Washington, and he said, you know, I can really smell a rat. Does anyone recognise that rat? Yeah, close, in a way. It's the rat that bit through the temporary electricity supply to the Fukushima pumps about a month ago and nearly caused another meltdown. So, there you go. I don't know why the connection is. I just thought,
matter, what? Work.
So anyway, this is and the stuff I'm talking about, okay? I'm not sort of, you know, trying to completely invent something new. This is happening. This is a great project. Well, it was a great project. This was by a bunch called the Excites Unit at UCL, which has also now become a social enterprise called Mapping for Change. And this was in Deptford, and they were mapping the noise levels. They had a scrapyard right in the middle. Okay, and they did citizen monitoring of the noise levels. And they discovered, of course, it was violating all regulations. And interestingly, compared to EU 9546 EC, they...
Well remembered.
I wrote it down, actually. But one of the I'm sure it'll stick in my mind now. One of the effects of this, that what's really interesting is what happens around it as well, of course. Right? It's not just the sensors and the data, it's everybody's sensor, it's not just the data. It's what people do with it. What they did was they had very interesting conversations, and some people got really into regulations. There was ordinary member of the community with no prior legal training or whatever, became an expert on national and European noise level legislation in order to pursue the case, you know, alongside their data measurements, etc., etc. And they did, and so same thing is what I learned out of this. This is actually Christian Nold's biomapping project. So I couldn't find a decent photo of that quickly enough. But this is another one. This is the old GPS plus your galvanic skin sensor to tell that your levels of stress and excitement match with your GPS coordinates. So it's this kind of psychogeography, scientific psychogeography, if you like. And, you know, these things, it's not just about the data. It's about what you do when you're faced with that data about you, etc., etc. So it's kind of sort of interesting and cursive as well. And what I would think of as this is a critical pedagogy, right? This is this Paulo Freire guy from the 60s, and he had this attitude towards education. Education either functions as an instrument which is used to facilitate the integration of generations into the logic of the present system, got that? And bring about conformity to it, or it becomes a practice of freedom, I'm aware of the time, you see. It becomes a practice of freedom, the means by which men and women deal critically with their reality and discover how to participate in the transformation of the world. It's just a mode of education. This guy was an educationalist. Okay, and I think this stuff, that's what citizen science is for me. It's participatory education. right? And empowerment and other stuff. Okay. I'll skip a few things. So here's a quote from me. The critical citizen scientist packs their DIY bio and flash mob to the nearest Lidl. So this was actually in Deptford. This was people from the Manchester Fab Lab going in down and do sort of tests for what else is in the meat in Deptford. So this, every hackerspace now has a DIY bio unit, right? So there's some really interesting possibilities out there. The point of which being, how long have we got? 5 minutes, right? 5 minutes, I'm going to an attempt to take down of 500 years of Western science. Or maybe not a complete slam down, but at least a little bit of a shimmy. Because I think there are many problems to making this stuff go forward, okay, but the main thing is probably not the technology or the practical technical skills. Definitely is community mobilisation. That's always a hard, labour-intensive, no easy way around it job. Okay, but I think the other blockage to this stuff, and I think this is definitely reinforced by the conversations I've had with Mookie Hapley, who's the guy who does these great projects like the Mapping for Change things, is that science itself is actually one of the problems. And because science has a certain worldview. Okay? And there's a really good book by Isabel Stengers called Cosmopolitics that's really worth reading if you want to see the roots of that. Well, I was educated as a physicist. I was a particle physicist originally. Okay, so, and Isabel Stengers has got a really good exploration of how a particular form of positivistic practice, of practical and experimental craft of measurement, transformed into a single explanation of everything. As Stephen Shavero says when he's summarizing Stengers, the problem is not with science's actual particular positive claims, but rather with its pretensions to universality, its need to deny the validity of all claims and practices other than its own. Now, there are ways around that as well. There's guys, Deleuze and Guattari had this thing about two kinds of science. Royal science, which is the official, straighted, sort of top-down one, and nomadic science, which the key thing about that probably is it's a science that does not have an ambition to totalise its knowledge. Okay? It's not trying to tell you the final full truth. And that's where this guy comes in, right? This is Foucault. Okay? So Foucault had that big thing about power knowledge. The basic idea being power is not just up there fooling us about the truth by throwing out illusions, but actually power is productive of truths, productive of our subject matter, productive of our bloody Wi-Fi, productive of subjectivities. Okay? It produces these truths. And Foucault's thing, because he was a dissident in that sense, he had this concept of the insurrection of subjugated knowledges. Right? This is from a lecture in 76. That is, of the historical contents that have been buried and disguised in a functional coherence or a formal systematization. By subjugated knowledges, Foucault means those naive knowledges located low down on the hierarchy beneath the required levels of cognition and scientificity. Scientificity. Yes. Okay. I'm trying to get something practical at the end, right? I'm trying to get around to what does it practically mean? Okay. Well, I think an aesthetic, actually. This is the aesthetic that came at the birth of science. It was Copernicus. It was symmetry. Actually, Ptolemaic epicycles were a much better explanation of the planets at the time that he came up with this. He wasn't motivated by experimental measurements. Okay, whatever the common narrative of the history of science, that wasn't the deal, right? The deal was something else, and the deal was strongly related to this idea of symmetry and purity and all that, and simplicity, and the kind of things that run through the practice of the theory of physics, actually. So here's an alternative aesthetic that's knocking around at the moment, something that's talked about by some people anyway. It's called a new aesthetic. And it just basically, one of the things it's trying to do is simply surface the fact that algorithms are under so much of our experience of life. Okay, they construct our realities and our subjectivities quite a lot right now. And they pop out in the aesthetic, they pop up everywhere. Because they're there, right? So they do leak into the aesthetic. So there's a thing called the new aesthetic. Okay, so I'm saying that actually we can do citizen science of a nomadic type, right? Of an insurrectionary type in the sense of knowledges under the banner of this kind of aesthetic. Right, see how long you can hack this one. Oh dear. So this is the glitch. The glitch aesthetic is another term for it, right? And I think that really speaks to me because I think the glitch is something quite important, actually, for this kind of scientific practice, to actually embrace the glitch. And that's what I found sort of worrying in a way. I'm going to put that off because that's too much, isn't it? This is actually somebody else's tweet from the launch of Summit, going back to the beginning. When I went on Tuesday, I found it absolutely fascinating. There's a lot of startup testosterone, and I was telling Chris, but also this kind of engineer approach. I haven't been around that for a while. It's really interesting to me because it is so singular. And this was a really nice guy from Arm. They're talking about the size of their processors. This is 1 millimeter square, two processors and a solar panel. Can it be a panel? The solar thing, right? And he actually used the phrase. It was absolutely brilliant. He used the phrase, a sensor you can snort. Brilliant. But what really floored me was...
Let's put it around.
Yeah, right. Ed, you didn't mention that, actually. But, you know, but the thing about that, you know, in the sense, and that was, but purely in the sense, it's really cool. I am, you know, I like technical details, and I find it absolutely fascinating, but the implications of that. I mean, if you've got a problem with car telematics, wait till they get you to start snorting your sensors when you go down the door office. You know? It's that we have to think about what the implications of these things are and do something about it in a participatory way. So where do we glitch this stuff practically? What do we do? Well, I thought a couple of days ago, in the timely way that Twitter has, threw me up an example. This is called the Migra hack. Migra hack. Act Migra hack. Immigration hack in the United States. Oh, that's brilliant. Immigration hack. That's what I'm talking about. Actually, it wasn't quite so cool because it's actually 60 journalists and 40 developers and not actually many, like, ordinary people or whatever. So it's not quite what I'm talking about. What I'm actually talking about is taking something like the Zively network and the fun and friendly sensors and really getting it to the communities that are least likely to have ever had access to this stuff and doing something interesting with it there. Right? And that has to be a positive step. We were talking about, Duncan was saying, you know, really about not doing, you know, not just not being evil, but really, really actually positively not doing evil. It's the same thing about sort of doing something useful. It's not just about being open. Okay, that doesn't actually change anything. You've got to really get out there and do something. Very proactive. Okay, and that's the glitch thing that I'm talking about. So I tried to sum it up to say, open sensor networks can help surface subjugated knowledges through good citizen science, but this won't happen through startups or the maker movement, but only through a critical and participatory practice. Wow. Okay.
If we can say thank you to Dan for that.
My second advert break was just, we're doing a crypto party at Goldsmiths University on Tuesday, 5 to 8 p.m. if you want to come along.
That's great. Thanks, everybody. We'll need to rush off to your next session. Loads of information there. Sorry, I haven't got any time for questions. But you've probably learned so much. Just get to it slowly. Well, that was just really